ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Cuba is facing the worst crisis in its history as Trump cuts off oil to the Caribbean island. Food is running short, international airlines have abandoned the place, epidemics are expected. Any nation assisting Cuba has been threatened with massive tariffs. I'll be discussing the state of Cuba later in the show with the historian and columnist Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez. How we dispose of the dead, apparently 36 million tons of bodies every year on Earth, is a matter of religious sensibility and deep cultural habit, of course, etc., etc., etc. But it comes at a cost to the environment. So, environmentally friendly ways of disposal of bodies is now on offer everywhere. But on closer examination, it looks as though we are greenwashing the dead. But first, the savage hold of gambling on Australia. How, you might wonder, is a trade that bleeds $31 billion from Australians each year so lightly regulated by Canberra? Governments from way back have stared down the nearly unanimous wish, 91% in recent polls, that gambling ads be banned entirely from primetime television. How can that be? Part of the answer, but only part, is the cash the gambling industry throws at political parties. And then there's the influence won by lobbyists, free to roam the corridors of Parliament, knocking on doors and bending ears on behalf of Tabcorp, Crown Resorts, Betfair, Sportsbet, Picklebet, Unibet and the rest. The Australian Democracy Network has just published a report, Gaming the System, 11 Years of Political Donations by the Gambling Industry, that looks at the slack regulation of lobbyists in Canberra, the least effective of any parliament in the land, and by international standards, just feeble. Christian Slattery, a senior campaigner with the Democracy Network, joins me now. Christian, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
Christian, what did your analysis of the money, of the political donations going back about 11 years, reveal?
Yeah, so we looked at that 11-year period from 2014 to 2025. And what we found is that over that period, the gambling companies have donated about $6 million to the major parties at the federal level. There's some really interesting parts of that, the patterns of that, those donations. What we find is that the money is split in a very bipartisan way. It's split almost exactly evenly between Labor, 3.1 million, and the Coalition, 3.2 million. I think one of the things that that tells you is, and to use a, I hate to use a gambling metaphor here, but this is an industry that is hedging its bets, that is trying to ensure that no matter which party is in government, it has the ear of decision makers.
Are they big donations compared to, say, the mining industry?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what often surprises myself even and others who look at these numbers is that it doesn't take a lot of money. I mean, $6 million for the gambling sector over a decade is absolute pocket change for this industry. It's incredibly cheap for these companies to buy access to our politicians. But unfortunately, that is what we see, is that politics has become a pay-to-play environment where these companies pour money, funnel money into our parties. And it happens at key moments. It happens during elections and in the lead-up to elections. And it happens in periods when there is debate about regulation, such as over the last 4 or 5 years.
But Christian, it's carrot and stick though, isn't it? I mean, the money they give the political parties to keep them sweet, that's the $6 million you're talking about. But there's also the threat of the money they can spend hammering the parties if they don't do what the industry wants.
No doubt about it, David, no doubt about it. This is a very sophisticated strategy of influence by big industries. I mean, we're talking about the gambling industry tonight, but we could be talking about any manner of big companies and big industries in this country, from the mining sector, the fossil fuel industry, the property sector. So you're right, like this is an ecosystem of influence. Donations is one part of the jigsaw puzzle where we actually have some transparency over. It's not ideal, but there is some transparency. What we don't have transparency over is the lobbying that those donations help to unlock. And as you say, it's carrot and stick. There's the PR campaigns that these industries are able to run to try and avoid regulation that would threaten their commercial interests.
I dug out some figures this afternoon. In the 2007 federal election, the mining industries contributed to the political parties a little over $1 million. And that was a new high for the mining industry's contribution to political parties. That's the election, of course, that Rudd won. A couple of years later, when Rudd was trying to tax the mining industry, they spent $22 million on a six-week advertising campaign to crush that proposal successfully. $1 million donations, $22 million bucks punishment.
Yeah.
But to the lobbying industry. Now look, Christian, I've got to admit, I knew that the regulation of the lobbying industry at the federal level was not so hot. But your report shocked me. It really did shock me. I want to go sort of step by step here. The gambling industry isn't just the gambling industry. There are lots of other industries that benefit from gambling, right? There's advertising, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the gambling industry has lobbyists, but all those other industries would have lobbyists too, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to sort of go back to a point you're making there around the money that's spent by these companies on political donations and how it sort of compares with the money that they spend on public relations campaigns. I think one of the things that's tricky about this is that we're not saying that the donations themselves, you know, buy a particular policy outcome. It's a much more sophisticated web of influence than that. But what we do know is that the donations buy access to speak to politicians. And we know that because the industries that are making these donations and the companies that are making these donations have told us that that is the case. So if you take the example of Woodside Energy, in 2018, they gave evidence to a parliamentary inquiry where they disclosed what their membership of the Labor Business Forum and the equivalent, you know, Liberal Party fundraising vehicle bought them. And it bought them things like attendance at various different parliamentary briefing events, attendance at policy forums throughout the year, budget night dinners with key politicians from both sides of the parliament, prime minister drinks with the prime minister and the opposition leader, end of year drinks with these people. So this is how these things are connected, and we're saying looking at the money gets us half of the way. And you know, now we need, as you say, there's a lot of work to do to overhaul Australia's lobbying laws to shine a spotlight on the way in which influence is exerted through lobbying.
Let me check that I've got this picture as bleakly as I think I've got it. First of all, there are no rules surrounding lobbyists who are actually employed by companies. These rules only apply to third-party lobbyists, to lobbying operations. So if you're employed by Tabcorp, you can roam around Parliament House without having to declare anything. Is that right?
That's right. So the Lobbyist Code of Conduct, which is the more or less the only lobbying rules that exist at the federal level, it was implemented in 2008, so it's almost 20 years old now. It's more a set of guidelines than actual rules. But that's right, it only covers what you might think of as a professional lobbyist, someone who is hired by a company to represent that company's interests to decision makers. It doesn't cover, you know, the in-house government relations staff who are employed by that company to represent that company in Canberra.
So it wouldn't cover a former minister who retires from politics and becomes employed by a gambling company.
That's my understanding, is that it would not cover
They're home free. They don't have to register anything. Okay. Now, I understand that the rules don't care about lobbying to opposition members of parliament. They only care, not very much, but they only care about lobbying to government members and government staff. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Christian, this is inconceivable. So they're only worried about third-party lobbyists who are approaching government ministers and staffs. Okay, now, what do they have to declare? What do the various people involved in those transactions have to publicly declare?
Well, at the federal level, very little, David. And actually, there's been some great research by Transparency International who've done a comparison between the Commonwealth in terms of the Commonwealth laws and how it compares to the Australian states and territories. And the Commonwealth falls at the back of the pack. It is the absolute laggard in the country with respect to lobbying rules. So in Queensland, in New South Wales, in Victoria, there is disclosure of things like ministerial diaries, and in some cases, lobbyists have to report the sort of contact that they've had with members of the government. There's an independent regulator in a whole heap of states. And at the federal level, despite over a dozen breaches of the supposed lobbyist code of conduct, not a single lobbyist has ever been sanctioned.
Okay, so a lobbyist goes to the office of a minister in Canberra. Does the minister have to tell the public they've seen this lobbyist? Does the lobbyist have to tell the public they've seen this minister?
No. The only way that could possibly come to light would be through freedom of information laws, which, as I'm sure you know, can be very challenging even to get disclosure through.
So that in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and the ACT, ministers have to actually publish their diaries. They have to show everybody who comes through the door to talk to them. But in Canberra, you don't.
Yeah, that's right. And look, there's questions around, you know, how far that disclosure should go. I mean, we would say it would also be appropriate to extend that disclosure to people like senior staffers and advisors to federal ministers, because often the conversations that will happen in Canberra will not happen directly with the minister. You know, these are incredibly busy people. They'll happen with advisors, they'll happen with the chief of staff. And so that should really be part of that diary disclosure as well.
So, ministers don't have to say who they're seeing, and members of the opposition benches, they don't have to say who they're seeing. Do the lobbyists have to say who they're seeing?
Not federally, no.
Okay, right. So, the lobbyists don't have to either. So, what is declared? Is anything declared, or is all of this behind closed doors?
The only declaration that I'm aware of is there's a federal lobbyist register, and that's effectively just a Rolodex of who the professional lobbying firms represent as clients. And that is effectively the only, the principle behind the entire structure of Australia's current lobbyist rules is about providing a line of sight between for the government and ministers and other parliamentarians to who a professional lobbyyist is representing in their meetings. Now, we would say there should be a much broader purpose to these laws, which is that the public have a right to know who is meeting with our politicians, what they are meeting about, when they're meeting them. That's why we say that transparency should be at the heart of any new laws.
But in Canberra, none of that applies.
No.
No. Well done. Well done, Canberra. This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, talking to Christian Slattery, senior campaigner of the Australian Democracy Network, about recent study of lobbying and gambling. Christian, how can any lobbyist need to be punished in Canberra? I mean, there don't seem to be any rules they can break.
No, I mean, that's part of the problem. And in fact, one of the only sort of substantive, what you might call a substantive rule, is with respect to what we describe as the revolving door between politics and big corporations. So under the Ministerial of Code of Conduct, there's supposedly an 18-month cooling off period between when a minister who might have been responsible for regulating a sector is supposed to wait before going and then working in that industry. But unfortunately, we see that routinely breached. I mean, many of your listeners would be familiar with the example of Christopher Pyne, who moved into a role after he was defence minister, doing lobbying for the defence industry. And in the gambling sector, there's a host of these revolving door appointments. So Responsible Wagering Australia is the chief lobby group for the online gambling
sector.
Isn't
it beautifully named, Christian? You've got to say it's beautifully named.
It's very strategic. I'll certainly give them that credit. But there, I'll just name three of the chairs of that organisation over the last 10 years, lest anyone think that this is not bipartisan. The first was Stephen Conroy, the former Labor Communications Minister. Then there was Richard Colbeck, who actually served as the chair of Responsible Wagering Australia between two terms of parliament. He is now senator. And the current chair of Responsible Wagering Australia is Nick Minchin, who was the former finance minister in the Howard government. So they certainly have some extensive political networks and knowledge that they are able to draw upon.
And as chairs of those organisations, they would, of course, not need even to be registered as lobbyists. They just go into parliament. Now, members of parliament can give passes to lobbyists. Is that right? I understand they're orange. They can give passes to lobbyists, and these passes allow lobbyists to wander the corridors of the whole building, right?
That's right. They're called sponsored passes. They effectively grant unrestricted access to the private parts of Parliament House.
Do we know who has these passes?
We don't. So this is something that Senator David Pocock has been advocating on very strongly in the last couple of years, that there should be transparency around those orange passes. I mean, we certainly would support more transparency of those orange passes. There's probably some appropriate, you know, privacy protections for people like whistleblowers and other at-risk community members, domestic violence survivors, other potential groups that may need to have some protections and privacy around. But broadly speaking, I think, more disclosure, more transparency around orange passes would be good. But it's part of this broader problem with the lobbying system. And that's why we actually need legislation at the federal level that would deal with this in its totality.
David Pocock recently wrote a dissenting report for yet another investigation into lobbying. It was tough, it was succinct, it was very impressive. Is the Pocock program more or less what you are also advocating? And what are the main changes that have to be made, do you think, in Canberra?
Yeah, it would be great to see the government act on this. I think for the laws to be durable, we'd want to see support for this across the parliament. I think there certainly is on the crossbench support for more transparency, obviously. The sorts of laws that we would want to see are things like timely disclosure of ministerial diaries, and including advisors and senior public servants in that sort of category as well, so that the public can see who is meeting with our elected representatives. And we'd want to see longer and stronger cooling off periods to stop ministers and senior advisors just moving immediately into roles with industry right after they've been in parliament and in politics. And then that needs to be accompanied with an independent watchdog to administer the lobbying rules and this is crucial, appropriate civil and criminal penalties to deter unethical and unlawful conduct. Because at the moment, you know, it's all well and good, even if we had these laws on the books, there would need to be a deterrent to help to change the culture that currently exists in Canberra around lobbying.
Under the present Canberra rules, do you see any prospect of the gambling industry being reined in?
I think that is a great question, and it's probably better to pose that question to the government. I think, as you said at the top of this discussion, you know, the gambling issue is one where there is enormous social harm in our communities. There is overwhelming public support for action. There's probably overwhelming parliamentary support for action, and yet it has been accompanied by long delays for reform. So, you know, we're talking about the influence that's happening behind closed doors, and we think the spotlight should really be shone on what is happening in those meetings.
Christian, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
A pleasure. Thanks so much.
I've been talking to Christian Slattery, senior campaigner at the Australian Democracy Network, about their new report, Gaming the System, 11 years of political donations by the gambling industry. Coming up next, is Trump determined to crush Cuba? One way or another, the United States has been trying to bust Cuba since the Communist Revolution of 1959. Trump is particularly determined. Almost all of Cuba's oil came from Venezuela, a supplier cut off by the United States since the kidnapping of President Maduro. The result is being described as the worst crisis in Cuba's recent history. Food is short, tourists have disappeared, international airlines can't fly in or out. With no fuel to drive garbage trucks, filth is piling up in the street, epidemics are expected any day, rolling blackouts are part of everyday experience of Cubans. For insight into the state of Cuba and its long quarrel with the United States, we're turning now to Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez, historian, expert on Latino-Hispanic politics and culture, and Pegasus Professor at the University of Central Florida. Luis, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join your show.
Luis, why won't the United States leave Cuba alone?
Well, that's a very good question. These two countries, ironically, were very close allies. When the United States declared war on Germany, the Cubans declared it the following day. So there's a long history of intimate ties. But then, like a couple, they decided to have a divorce, and it's been rough ever since.
One of the things America seems, though, to fear is 3 or 4 million Cubans heading for Florida.
Yes, that's a possibility. That's why I don't think anybody wants a transition, and I think there will be a transition to something to be bloody and sudden without controls. I think it's in the best interest of everybody that we don't see a bloody transition, a kind of civil war. And I'm pretty sure it could be averted. And you're right. Cubans have been migrating in large numbers to the United States. In the past 3 or 4 years before Trump became president, the flow accelerated to unprecedented levels as far as the numbers and proportion.
Those people include yourself and your own family. I mean, you were born in Cuba, I understand.
Yes, I was born in Cuba in 1960. A few days later, the United States and Cuba broke diplomatic relations. And yes, we've been out of the island. I've had the opportunity to visit several times to do research back in the 90s and early 2000s.
But you're now based in Florida.
That's correct.
Luis, you wrote even before, and it was just a few days before, Maduro was kidnapped by the Americans. You wrote that by every measure, the Cuban regime, is closer to the brink than ever. Then comes the kidnapping, then comes the cutting off of oil supplies. How much closer to the brink do you think Cuba now is?
Yeah, far closer. When I wrote that piece in September, I was not ready to declare that the regime's fall was imminent, that it would happen within the next few months. I was not ready. But you mentioned those two circumstances, plus the fact that the Cuban people don't even have water. I mean, it's one thing to have scarcities of food, but there's no water. Transportation is at its standstill. Buildings are collapsing on a daily basis. So it's far worse. And I'll say it here first. I don't think that the regime as it is will be in place 6 months from now.
What is the regime? Are you talking about a family group that's still holding power?
It's a little bit more than that, because Díaz-Canel, the president, has really established himself as the authority outside of the shadow of the Castros. He's firmly in place. But I do think that, and, you know, there are reports, although Cuba denies this, that there are high-level conversations that have taken place in Mexico and elsewhere to accelerate a transition that would definitely represent the end of the Díaz-Canel government.
And there are also reports of the descendants of Castro who are living it up in Cuba, who are quite unafraid to flaunt wealth.
Yes, that's yet another wrinkle in this. You know, it's one thing for the Cuban leadership to leave austere lives, given that everybody else is going through such difficulties as far as even acquiring food. But these children and grandchildren have taken it to another level. These were ostentation, flaunting wealth, showing a complete disregard for the pain of the Cuban people. Now, that's not the case with the two children of Raúl Castro, Alejandro Castro Espín and Mariela Castro Espín. They're not at that level, but certainly they live very well. And in recent weeks, we've seen reports of Mariela obtaining a large home in Italy. There are reports, I can't confirm them, that her husband was arrested upon arrival to Italy carrying some bullion. So yes, there's signs of desperation in the leadership and their descendants.
This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez about the state of things in Cuba at the moment. Luis, who do Cubans blame for the predicament they now find themselves in?
Well, that has changed over time. You know, the notion that it is the U.S. embargo that has been the cause of Cuba's suffering is long gone. Even Che Guevara, back in the early 1960s, said, "We cannot blame all of our ills with the embargo excuse." And the government is still presenting itself as a victim of the embargo. Just a few days ago, they were saying that the scarcities of food are because of the U.S. embargo. There is no embargo on food, I'm sorry to say, and other countries can trade. The issue is that Cuba does not have the cash, does not have that ability to purchase so many things, including oil. But as you said, in the case of oil, it is now an embargo, and the Cuban government cannot really work around that. That's why they don't have oil and fuel, even for airplanes. That's unheard of.
Are the debts of Cuba essentially unrepayable?
Yes, they are. They have been unrepayable for a long time. I don't think Cuba is getting any more credit anywhere in the world. That's very evident, because they don't have money even to update or repair the electric grid and the infrastructure. That debt is unrepayable.
Is the animus of the United States, particularly of Trump, driven by, a desire for revenge, shall we say, of the Cuban community now living in the United States? Is this something that can win votes for Trump?
That's a good question. The honeymoon between Trump and Cuban voters, particularly in Florida, is really over. Many Cubans, as you know, supported his candidacy, voted for him. And then they've seen that their spouses or their cousins or other relatives who came to the United States in the last 3-4 years, now they're being sent back to Cuba. So many pro-Trump supporters who couldn't vote, actually, are now being sent back to Cuba. I will be very honest with you. I think that for us Cubans who have been in exile for a long time, we really want to see an end to that regime. I mean, we were pushed out and we weren't able to go back in most cases, and we would like to see an end. Now, how that comes about is something that we're split. Some would like to see a complete end of the regime. Others would like to see a negotiated transition that includes some other figure that is not Díaz-Canel or perhaps even the Castro brothers. But yes, we would like to see it come to an end. Now, it's interesting to see, and I hesitate to use the word or the phrase the Trump doctrine, because it's too serious of a word to associate with Trump, but maybe the Marco Rubio doctrine, as has played out in Venezuela, is one of a elimination of the top leadership with the hope that there will be first the freedom of political prisoners, and then perhaps even elections. Now, behind all of this, and we shouldn't fool ourselves, is the desire on the part of Trump to open Cuba economically, to open Cuba for the hotel business for American capital, which, by the way, other capital is leaving Cuba in the area of tourism. That's how bad things are. And I'm talking about European and Asian capital that is rapidly withdrawing. So it is.
So it's Trump and hotels again, like Trump in Gaza, Trump in Cuba. Once again, it's resort hotels.
Yes. That's whom the American people voted for. Hotelier that is also, somebody who is not inclined toward democracy. On the contrary, that is whom we voted for. Not me.
The Cuban president has said that there are high-level talks now going on between his government and Washington. Do you know much about those? Do you know what they're about, who's conducting them?
Mike Hammer, who is the U.S. envoy to Cuba, I think is the ambassador still, has been very active more than anybody else. And he has a style of, he has a very friendly style towards Cuban dissidents, Cuban people in general. He's gotten away with a lot as far as, meeting with dissidents and those who oppose the regime. He is a key player. He's not Trump. He's got manners, I would say, and he's sort of likable. And he has been the point man. As far as the meetings...
Remind us, Lewis, who he is, Hammer.
He is... Mike Hammer was named by Trump to be the top U.S. envoy to Cuba. Uh-huh. He leads the embassy.
Right. What are Cuba's allies doing? I mean, Mexico has been a close ally of Cuba. Moscow, of course, has always been there to some extent supporting the place. What are they doing about this latest tussle?
Yeah, well, Venezuela is out of the game as far as supporting Cuba. Russia has its own issues, its own economic issues. It has been sending oil until the recent embargo to Cuba. I don't see much of that happening in the future. Russian vessels have been stopped on their way to Cuba, so that takes care of that. Mexico has to play it very carefully regarding how far they can go with this. I think the U.S. might allow partial shipment. The other country, which has traditionally been, if not an ally, at least in unfriendly terms with Cuba, is Spain. The government just announced humanitarian help in terms of food and other essential items.
So you give the regime 6 months, but do you see any real risk of a military action by Trump, of invasion of some kind?
That, you know, the administration is unpredictable as far as those things go. I think it wouldn't be as easy as it was with the capture of Maduro. The Cuban government has, as poor as it is in so many regards, unable to provide electricity, food, and water. As poor as it is, its military is still very strong. So it wouldn't be as easy to carry out a Maduro extraction-like operation. There would be definitely American casualties. So I think they're weighing in that. And they don't want to see American soldiers die in any operation.
Mm-hmm. Lewis, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking to Dr. Lewis Martinez-Fernandez, historian, political analyst, and Pegasus professor at the University of Central Florida, about the state of Cuba. Coming up, how green is your funeral? After all we've burned up in our lives, after all the damage we've done to the universe, cremation, it seems, only makes things worse. That smoke drifting out of the chimney puts more filth into the atmosphere than a car driving 3,000 kilometres. So these days, more than ever, we're looking for earth-friendlier ways of disposing of ourselves once we're dead. My guest, Hannah Gould, writes that new death technologies, yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is the term, death technologies, are offering to absolve our ecological sins by folding our bodies seamlessly back into the earth. But she accuses the green funeral trade of making wild claims that don't stand up to scrutiny. Can we truly hope to die green? She asked in a recent article in the digital magazine Eon. Or is it all just greenwashing? Hannah is a cultural anthropologist at Melbourne University, a senior lecturer in Buddhist studies, and one of that university's Death Tech research team. Hannah, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hannah, please explain. What is the work of the Death Tech research team?
Well, Death Tech has been part of the University of Melbourne for around about a decade now. And it's exactly what's on the tin. So we study the relationship between death, human mortality mostly, but sometimes fairy friends, and technology. So that's everything from the technology of, say, social media, Instagram, Facebook these days, AI holograms that promise to tweet for you beyond the grave, all the way through to other technologies around the handling of the body or, say, technologies we might use at a funeral. So how do those new technologies change how we face the end of our lives and deaths, but also kind of what they say more broadly about human mortality and just, you know, a small question, our place in the universe.
And you've counted the cost, the ecological cost of funerals. Mm. I love the fact that you've paid attention to the cost of importing granite or finding and sculpting the granite. But what about your heartless remark that the persistent visiting of graves does damage to the atmosphere? Can you justify that?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things, is that I think a lot of people are concerned about the environmental cost of death, right? It makes sense. If we're concerned about the environmental cost of our lives, everything from, you know, where we buy our groceries to the, you know, decision to have children or not, the decision to buy a new car, you know, how many overseas holidays should we go on? So if we're concerned about those things, then it makes sense that we might also be concerned about death and dying. Now, it's not to say don't ask your friends and family to visit a grave, but it is to say that we need to think about all of the different parts of death that contribute to its environmental impact. The conclusion might be, hey, we don't really need to worry about it at all. And I think that's probably more towards where I land for the individual. But it is important to kind of, you know, calculate that. And often there are a lot of little hidden costs, as you say, from the granite imported, you know, people traveling from overseas to come into your funeral, or even something as small as, you know, where are you buying the flowers from to put on the grave? Are they Aussie flowers? Are they local? Or are they, you know, from a Dutch flower market that you're importing all the way over here?
There are cultures that surely point the way. I'm thinking Zoroastrians. I mean,
a very eco-death.
A very eco-death. Describe.
So Zoroastrians are a minority religious community found in many places around the world, but particularly, say, in contemporary India and Pakistan. And traditionally, within this culture, the means of disposing of body is something called excarnation or exposure. So exposure of the body to vultures, right? We're going to ask animals to pick the bones, take away all the flesh until you're just left with those bones that can then be handled with care or disposed of. And that's not just a technique that happens in Zoroastrian communities in these kind of big towers of silence. They're called dakma that exist in some cities in India, for example. But there's many traditions that practice that. So classically, you think of sky burial, right, in the Himalayas. Now, if you're looking for an eco-death solution, this is a very friendly one because obviously we're not putting any carbon to the atmosphere. We're actually asking animal kin to take care of the body. But it is also an eco-death solution that is threatened by climate change because if you don't have enough vultures in the population, then you can no longer practice this form of death care. So it's very much linked to humans' relationship with nature. And maybe also not practical for central CBD of Sydney or Melbourne.
No. But look, have Christians had a particular interest in preserving bodies?
I think a lot of different religious traditions and cultural traditions are very much interested in preserving the body. I mean, we think Egyptian mummification, for example, pre-Christian rites that focus on preserving the body. But within kind of Christian traditions, certainly there has been kind of a focus on preserving the body until the second coming, until the resurrection. Depending on your theological reading of the resurrection, that might be actually an embodied resurrection, right? The bodies are brought forth from the grave.
Yes, incorruptible.
So therefore it's important they're in good nick.
Yes.
And from that we see a lot of techniques to do with embalming, preserving the body, making sure it's in a coffin, a nice casket, even grave liners, concrete grave liners, lots and lots of things to make sure that we kind of keep the rot out, keep people as fresh as possible for as long as possible.
But there's always been a wish to, you know, can't you just put me in the bush somewhere? Can't you just bury me in a paddock? Can't you just, you know, do something completely natural? But there are a lot of laws against that, aren't there? You can't just bury a body in a paddock.
Well, I will say that working as a scholar in Australia, I'm always impressed by a particular strain of what we might call like Aussie necropragmatism or materialism.
Hannah, please, can we have that word again?
Necropragmatism.
Wonderful, thank you.
I think Aussies are pretty pragmatic when it comes to the dead body, necro, the body. The number of, you know, farmers, people I meet, everyday people on the street who just say, just chuck me in a hole, mate. I'll be right. You know, no fuss, no flowers. I don't want a big hullabaloo. I don't need a party. Don't even need a funeral. Dig a hole, put me in it. She'll be right. A very down-to-earth Aussie approach to death. Interestingly, probably has something to do with our history in World War II and Australian death culture and bigger story there. But it is not always as simple to do that. It's not as easy to have that dream realised. There are lots of laws, and I think for probably very good reason, about where you can put dead bodies. And, you know, as much as we might like to say, yes, you're allowed to bury on private land, what happens if that private land gets sold? You know, what happens in 10, 20, yes. 30, 100 years down the track when all of a sudden you've got a cemetery that is basically being torn apart because it's been sold? So there are a lot of laws in place that in some ways make where you dispose of a dead body more difficult, but in other ways are probably very good safeguards to have in place.
Hannah, let's look at some of these new methods of disposing of bodies. Alkaline hydrolysis. Have I got that right?
Alkaline hydrolysis. This is the one that most people kind of confuse with serial killers and vats of acid. Very much not that. So this is the dissolving of the body in an alkaline solution. So a solution of water that's had its pH changed to be alkaline through lye or other different additives. Sometimes that's heated, sometimes and it's then agitated. The process is in some ways kind of similar to cremation in the sense that the remains are placed into a large vessel after a period of a few hours. What the result is bones, white, clean bones. Then those are ground down and we kind of get the same thing you would get from cremation. Ashes, right? So it's sometimes called water cremation or flameless cremation. Very different process, but it's a process that began in medical institutions in the US in order to handle the remains of donor bodies to medical programs and has recently become more popular for a general audience in the US, but also is now available in a select number of providers in Australia, in different states and territories.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Hannah Gould about the new technologies of burial. Hannah, that sounds pretty energy intensive, all of that work, you know, melting, crushing, et cetera, et cetera. Is it much of a plus for the environment?
So this is where it becomes really tricky. And I think this is where we both lack good quality evidence and research, but also we fall prey to these big claims because these are private providers and most of them are trying to convince you, but also convince grieving families that their method is more environmentally friendly. So as I outline in the article, you know, you stumble across these providers who say things like, well, this technology is 570-something% more green than cremation, or it saved X number of tons of carbon dioxide. And the reality is that is extremely difficult to calculate. Not only do these technologies all vary between country to country, they also vary just between state to state, between cremator machine to cremator machine might have very different environmental impacts. We can give you some kind of broad guidelines to say that, look, maybe alkaline hydrolysis has a smaller environmental footprint, and that's probably true in some use cases. At the same time, if you live next to a crematorium, probably going to that crematorium is probably going to be more environmentally friendly simply because the transport costs for transporting the body are more than the saving that would be from one or the other. So it's a really, really, really complicated kind of calculation about which one is, I suppose, technically, scientifically more green on an individual level. What I'd hate for people to worry about is to think about, you know, making a choice for themselves or their loved one and being concerned about, I was going to say counting calories, but counting carbon in the final disposition is not something that I think an individual should be concerned with.
What about the lure of Capsula Mundi?
So this is where it becomes interesting because even though we don't have that kind of good, solid research or evidence, people are indeed, allured by, captured by this idea of a green death, right? This kind of beautiful, romantic idea of, you know, lay me down on a bed of moss and plant a tree sapling on my stomach and it will grow into this gorgeous tree. And I'm in the unfortunate position of having to tell people that if you do that, you will probably kill the tree.
Fair warning.
Fair warning. I mean, dead bodies are not a great environment for young saplings, young trees. Maybe later down the decomposition process. There's a lot going on when somebody dies. I think the fact that despite the kind of lack of technology, despite how technically difficult some of these things might be, the fact that so many people, when I talk to them about death, and I'm always the one in the room doing that, they say, oh, I'd love to become a tree. Like, just plant a tree on me. I don't want a headstone. You know, I want a gorgeous eucalyptus or I want a lovely weeping willow. I think that says something really about almost like an emerging spirituality in Australia today, that we really resonate not with a posthumous journey up to heaven, but instead a return to the earth, to being part of nature. And I think that's really important to keep in mind.
And in the Aon article, you talk about a cemetery where you are allowed to choose the kind of tree that fits your personality. But we won't go there because we've only a moment left. Hannah, what are your rules for conducting an environmentally friendly funeral on traditional lines?
So here are my rules. First of all, work out what is important to you and work out what you're not willing to sacrifice. If it's important that all of your friends and family are there and they travel from overseas, great. That's what's important. That's not what you're willing to sacrifice. And then in those things that you do think you might have a bit of wiggle room, you can make some eco solutions. So pick, say, a cardboard coffin or a coffin from recycled wood, as opposed to one that's, you know, imported or that is, you know,
gold handles.
Gold handles, a gold-plated coffin, all are options, but maybe not the eco choice. And then finally, just try and do things in your life that have a better environmental impact as opposed to your death. At the end of the day, how you choose to dispose of your body, how you choose to handle your loved one's body is such a small percentage of your total ecological impact. I recommend instead that you write a letter to your MP, donate some money to an environmental cause, live green before you worry too much about dying green.
Hannah, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
I have been talking to Hannah Gould, an academic from Melbourne University, one of the co-authors of an extraordinary article in the digital magazine Aon, and she is the sole author of a new book which is about to appear, How to Die in the 21st Century, a whole new way to talk about death. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, we talk to one of those operatives who teaches politicians how not to tell the truth, how to lie without blushing, apologise without owning up, and how to never, ever answer the question. Plus, Ian Dunt is looking at the collapse of Keir Starmer, a man with a huge majority and yet no friends. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.